The Importance of Hard Industries. From 17th century Spain to 20th century Britain, the dynamics of eventual decline supported the arguments of those who had contended that finance could not replace manufacturing and that national economies needed the broader base. The bluntest case for hard industries was made by Britain's former colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, in 1904. Whereas England was once the greatest manufacturing country, he said, its people are now more and more employed in finance, in distribution, in domestic service. But over the long term, Britain could not survive as merely a hoarder of invested securities if it was not also the creator of new wealth. Then he asked his audience of bankers, "Granted that you are the clearinghouse of the world, but are you entirely beyond anxiety as to the permanence of your great position? Banking is not the creator of our prosperity, but the creation of it. It is not the cause of our wealth, but it is the consequence of our wealth. And if the industrial energy and development which has been going on for so many years in this country were to be hindered or relaxed, then finance and all that finance means will follow trade to the countries which are more successful than ourselves." But while this was one of the most accurate predictions in British commercial history, it did not carry the day. Part of what made these contentions unpersuasive to elites was the perception that finance and its services represented a higher stage of evolution, what late 20th century observers would laud as post-industrialism. As Paul Kennedy has explained, complex finances made Britain more rather than less vulnerable by the turn of the 20th century. Yet policymakers then were attracted to the idea that, should other nations industrialize, Britain would become the financial and commercial service center to the world. The United Kingdom was different, as one observer put it, because it was the first frog-spawned egg to grow legs, the first tadpole to change into a frog, the first frog to hop out of the pond. Harvard economic historian David Landes saw the first steps toward post-industrialism as having been taken even earlier. By the late 1700s, most wealthy Dutch were big landowners, high state officials or rentiers. Gone were the prosperous enterprisers of the Golden Age. Employers were now confined to the middle or lower ranks. In the process, the United Provinces abdicated as world leader in trade and manufacture and went into a post-industrial mode. Italy had gone that way before. In Venice, for example, the wool craft had sunk under the burden of taxes. Key industries had migrated to cheaper lands, and businessmen had reinvested their fortunes in agriculture on the mainland. Both Venice and Florence were already taking on the role of tourist magnets, living on the wealth of erstwhile competitors. In the aggregate, Holland was still wealthy, as Adam Smith's observations show, but estimates of income or product per head in 1750 to 1870 have it going nowhere. Other, more active nations were passing it by. Post-industrialism, then, may be more a quest for genteel retirement than a real economics-based future for a major power. Weary global economic powers seem uniquely vulnerable. Those who insist that the manufacturing imperative still applies to the present-day United States invoke three powerful examples: Germany, Switzerland, and Japan. All three nations have wages or overall production costs higher than those in the United States. All have reasonably successful financial sectors and post-industrial accomplishments: tourism, ecological awareness, and renewable energy emphases, wind in Germany, solar power in Japan. However, they balance these with highly developed manufacturing industries. For Germany, machinery, vehicles, chemicals, and metal products are the great exports. For Switzerland, chemicals, metal products, machinery, and mechanical engineering products, especially clocks and watches. And for Japan, vehicles, electronics, and computers. Each nation's products command global respect for quality. Indeed, German, Japanese, and Swiss export prowess puts the once mighty United States to shame. In 2003 and 2004, the U.S. trade deficit in manufactured goods rose from $470 billion to $552 billion. The three better-balanced economies, by contrast, enjoyed huge surpluses in trade and manufactured goods, and large ones in their overall current accounts. A set of statistics will demonstrate the point. Estimates for 2004, provided by the CIA in mid-2005, put Germany first in the world with $893 billion in exports, mostly manufactured goods. This from a national population of 82 million. The United States placed second with exports of $795 billion. Not exactly a triumph because, one, the United States had a population of 296 million, and two, these exports were dwarfed by $1.3 trillion worth of imports. The Japanese, chalking up the world's third highest export total, $538 billion, did so with a national population of 127 million. Pocket-sized Switzerland was even more of a per capita powerhouse. With a national population of only 7.5 million, it exported $131 billion worth of goods in 2004. Keep in mind the entire equation. The Germans, Japanese, and Swiss do this with workforce wages and benefits and industrial production costs as high as or higher than those in the United States. Needless to say, all three countries are net creditor nations, enjoy strong current accounts surpluses, and have citizens who achieve relatively high savings rates. During the quarter century after 1980, while the U.S. economy was undergoing financialization, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, credited all three with stronger growth rates than the United States. One would not guess that from American media coverage. Old Europe, in particular, is supposedly verging on economic palsy.